Lecture 48, Remembering the War.
Our final lecture will move from description and analysis of people and events during the war to a consideration of how those who experienced the conflict chose to remember it. We'll begin by examining the ways in which Northerners recalled the conflict in the decades after Appomattox, and then take up the topic of how former Confederates constructed their own memories, private and public, of the founding of the Confederacy and that slaveholding republic's short and turbulent life. The reconciliation movement of the late 19th century will be our third topic, followed by some observations about how modern Americans should try to understand the people and events of 1861 to 1865. But let's begin with the North. Just talk about some of the ways that the North followed through on the war and remembered the war. Politically, Republicans followed up on wartime emancipation with the three great Civil War amendments to the Constitution, the 13th, which passed in December of 1865, as we've seen, which ended the institution of slavery, the 14th Amendment, which sought to guarantee equal protection under the laws to all people in the United States, among other things, and the 15th Amendment, which granted the franchise to black males of voting age. Those three major changes in the Constitution, I think, showed that many people in the North, in fact, probably a majority of people in the North, believe strongly enough that black rights ranked high enough on the scale of things related to the Civil War that they were worth following through with during Reconstruction. Now, I don't think that changes the fact that most people in the North had always considered union as the most important goal of the war. But they did follow through in these very important ways on issues related to emancipation and the fate of black people after emancipation. In politics, Republicans made great, enormous progress during the war and afterward in terms of establishing themselves as the dominant national party, certainly in presidential politics. They controlled the White House for the most part after the war through the decades of the 19th century and well into the 20th century. They had run their first candidate in 1856, as we've seen, elected their minority candidate in Lincoln the second time out, but then they were the dominant presidential party for the rest of the century. They had great success in part because they wrapped themselves in the Union flag, the United States flag from the war, and engaged in politics that some people have described as waving the bloody shirt politics. This has its origin in one person who was campaigning who literally waved a tunic, a Union soldier's tunic that had blood on it from the war. But what this meant was that the Republicans would try, and with great success in many instances, to cast the Democrats as the party of treason, the party who'd worked against the Union, the party who had almost brought the great American democratic experience to an end. Let me quote from one piece of bloody shirt campaign rhetoric. This is from the 1876 elections. It's Republican James G. Blaine urging his fellow Republicans to vote as they shot during the war. This is how he put it. Every prison guard who tortured Union prisoners at Andersonville was a Democrat. The man who shot Abraham Lincoln was a Democrat. Every man who tried to tear the old flag from the heaven it enriches was a Democrat. Every man who has tried to destroy the nation was a Democrat. Soldiers, every scar you have on your heroic bodies was given to you by a Democrat. Well, that kind of appeal, I think, resonated powerfully among many Union veterans, especially, and it helped the Republicans maintain a powerful national position in the post-war years. They were very successful in electing former generals to the White House. Ulysses S. Grant won in 1868 and again in 1872. Rutherford B. Hayes followed him in 1876, James Garfield in 1880, and Benjamin Harrison in 1888. All of those men had been Union generals. William McKinley, who was elected in 1896, also was a Union veteran, although not a general, but again, a solid Union veteran, a patriot who had done his duty run by the Republicans.